Hey everybody, my name is Scott Killian. I'm a fourth year medical student at Southern Illinois University going into emergency medicine. And today I want to talk about volume resuscitation. The goal of this is to get you to be able to talk somewhat intelligently about fluids instead of defaulting to normal saline for everybody because that's what you see everywhere. So we'll start with some terminology. You're going to hear the terms crystalloid and colloid solutions. Crystalloid solutions are salt solutions composed of small solutes, primarily which is sodium chloride. The characteristic of these fluids, such as normal saline, half normal saline, lactated ringers, plasma light, normal sol, is that only about 25% will stay intravascularly, while the other 75% will diffuse out of the vessels and expand the interstitium. This is in contrast to colloid solutions, which are particulate solutions with particles that don't dissolve completely. So they're basically suspensions. Therefore, they're going to have oncotic pressure, and the fluid you're giving won't necessarily diffuse out into the interstitial spaces as much as your crystalloid solutions will. So example of these are any kind of blood products, then albumin, which comes in 5% or 25% solutions. And then if you wanted to get fancy and impress your attendings, you have hydroxyethyl starches and dextrans, which you probably won't see much, but those are other examples of colloid solutions. So when you talk about volume resuscitation, there's generally a few types of fluids that get used. The first is normal saline. And when you compare normal saline to plasma, there's quite a few differences, which is why it gets the caveat of there's nothing normal about normal saline. So in a 0.9% sodium chloride saline solution, which is normal saline, there's about 154 milliequivalents per liter of sodium compared to about 140 milliequivalents per liter in plasma. And then you take the chloride component, which is about 154 in the normal saline compared to the 103 milliequivalents per liter in plasma, and you can see there's quite a bit of difference in the electrolytes there. So when you're giving large volume resuscitation, you are going to see electrolyte swings and the physiological effects of that. Normal saline also has a higher osmolality and a lower pH. So the pH of normal saline can be around 5.7 compared to normal physiological pH of plasma of 7.4. So because of all these differences, they can cause things such as interstitial edema due to that sodium load, as well as metabolic derangements due to that high chloride load. So when you see a decreasing bicarb in somebody's BMP, but you gave them 3 liters of normal saline and there's no gap acidosis, usually that gets blamed on all the normal saline you gave them, and usually it's correctly so. Now we can compare this to lactated ringers. First off, lactated ringers, Ringer's lactate, Hartmann solution, those are all the same thing. Now, there are some big differences between lactated ringers and normal saline. So lactated ringers has less sodium, about 130 milliequivalents per liter, and less chloride, about 109 milliequivalents per liter. And then in addition to these two electrolytes, there's also calcium and potassium added. Very small amounts, though, only about 4 milliequivalents per liter of potassium and about 3 milliequivalents per liter of calcium. So as you can see from that near physiologic chloride load of lactated ringers, you're less likely to see a significant acid-base derangement when using this fluid. One contraindication to using lactated ringers is the use of it with packed red blood cells. Packed red blood cells have citrated anticoagulants, and if this comes in contact with the ionized calcium and lactated ringers, it can cause it to precipitate. So there are a couple of myths surrounding the use of lactated ringers. One of which is that you have a patient with a lactic acidosis and you don't want to get them any more lactate. However, the lactate in lactated ringers is a sodium lactate. It's different than the lactic acid that's being produced and causing your acidosis. Also, the pH of lactated ringers is more physiologic than normal saline. The other myth is that you have a patient on dialysis and you don't want to give them any more potassium. And since there's some potassium in lactated ringers, you think it's savvy to avoid that solution. However, there's only about 4 milliequivalents per liter of the potassium in lactated ringers. This is a pretty small amount of potassium,
and unlikely to cause much fluctuation in total body potassium. However, if you were to use large volumes of normal saline and induce an acidosis, this could cause a flux in potassium ions from intracellular, extracellular, and could transiently cause hyperkalemia. The other balanced solution is plasmolite. And the difference between plasmolite and lactate ringers is that plasmolite has magnesium instead of calcium, and it has gluconate buffers, which theoretically give it a physiological pH. Another advantage of plasmolite is that it can be used with packed red blood cells since it doesn't have the calcium and won't cause the precipitation. The most common colloid used for volume resuscitation would be blood products. The three most common blood products are packed red blood cells, fresh frozen plasma, and platelets. There's also cryoprecipitate, which is a more concentrated form of FFP, which has a high load of fibrinogen. So when you have a patient who's hemorrhaging in front of you, obviously they're losing blood, therefore they're going to need more blood. So your first deciding point is to decide how much blood you think they're going to lose. If it's a contained bleed, you might not need to give them large amounts of red blood cells. You might be able to get away with 2 units of packed red blood cells and have them fully resuscitated. But if you think a patient's going to need more, then you might have to activate a massive transfusion protocol. So a massive transfusion is defined as replacement of more than one blood volume in 24 hours or more than 50% of a patient's blood volume in 4 hours. And then you can estimate a adult patient's blood volume by doing 70 mLs per kilogram. And then in children, it's about 80 mLs per kilogram. So if you have a massive bleed and you think you're going to potentially need that much blood, then you activate a massive transfusion protocol. So you'll send a type in cross match and you'll get vascular access, and then you'll be giving blood products. When you give massive transfusion, you can't just give packed red blood cells because then you'll end up getting coagulopathies and more downstream problems. Therefore, you give certain ratios of the PRBCs, the FFP, and platelets. So the ratio you should remember is 1:1:1. So 1 unit PRBCs, 1 unit platelets, and then 1 unit FFP. In that ratio when you're giving large amounts of blood. Different systems will do it differently, but the idea is more important than remembering the specific ratios. All right, so now you've identified a patient that you think is going to need volume resuscitation. You might even know what fluid you want to give them, but that bag of normal saline laying on the patient's bed isn't going to do much good if you can't get it inside their veins. So you're going to need to establish intravascular access. So when you're considering what vascular access you're going to obtain, it's important to think about what kind of flow rates you're going to need for your patient. If a patient just needs 500 milliliters over a couple hours to fill their tank up, then it's not as important as the patient you think is going to need 2 liters over the next half hour in order to maintain their blood pressure. Because in that patient, the 20 gauge in their hand isn't going to fly, and you're going to need to establish larger bore IVs. So the go-to saying is, I want 2 large bore IVs in both antecubital fossas. And this will get you 2 16-gauge IVs, which would provide adequate flow rates to infuse large amounts of fluid. So everything I'm saying right now is contained within Pasul's Law. Now, you don't need to remember all the numbers that go in Pasul's Law, but you do need to remember that flow is directly proportional to the radius to the fourth power, and then it's inversely proportional to the length. Now, if you can't remember all of that, just remember short and thick does the trick. Sounds silly, but it sticks. So when you're going to want to provide high flows, you're going to want a short catheter with a thick lumen. And you might get asked about this by your attendings. They might say something like, I have a triple lumen central venous catheter. Should we use that to volume resuscitate our patient? And the answer would be no, because that lumen is small and it also has a very long length. It'd be more efficacious to use a thick, large bore peripheral IV to provide large volumes of fluid. Now, in a perfect world, we can get 16-gauge IVs on every patient that comes through the door. However, this isn't always true. Sometimes peripheral access will be nearly impossible, and there won't be enough time to proceed with central access. In cases like that, you don't want to waste a lot of time. You should just proceed to getting an intraosseous device and IO. And each site has different flow rates that tend to go along with it. So sternum tends to have the highest flow rates, then humerus, then tibia. But in a time whenever you need to give meds or just any fluid, you probably just go with whatever site you think is going to be easiest. So now you have intravascular access, you know what fluid you're going to give, and then they ask you for what rate you want to put it at. So one common saying is that you want the IV to be set at wide open to gravity. So they're going to hang the bag and it's going to drip in as quick as gravity lets it go. Another option would be to use pressure bags, which would provide pressure on the fluid bag to give it a faster rate. And then there's also the option of getting rapid infusion catheters, which are essentially short and very fat catheters that require some dilation to get in, and then using a rapid infuser, which will provide even greater flows. This is more likely to be used whenever you have massive hemorrhage and you need to get a lot of volume in. And with that, we'll be done. I hope you got something out of this, and it'll be applicable next time you have a patient that needs fluids or in simulation. If you want to do further reading, I got a lot of the reference material from Marino's ICU book. There's also a lot of good foam med resources out there, blogs and podcasts by people that are way smarter than I am. So check those out. All right. Thank you.